Thanks so much for making time for our discussion here, Glenn. And maybe I can first of all just ask you a little bit about what brought you here to Connecticut in this conference. What's the importance of people getting together talking about civil liberties issues in your mind? I mean, I know you travel quite a bit and you probably see gatherings like this. Are they important?
I think it's extremely important, and I think that's true for a couple of reasons. Number one is that when you're able to be in the same place physically as people who are passionate about defending civil liberties and about defending these core liberties, it can just embolden you. That kind of energy of being around other people who are similarly impassioned makes you realize that there's a lot of groundswell and a lot of people who are actually really concerned about these issues, and I think can give you a sense of purpose and possibility. But I also think that, you know, people who think about civil liberties and who focus on these kind of abridgments, all of us have different perspectives about why we care about these things, about the ways in which we're being personally affected. So it can, I think, underscore that these are not abstract issues, that these are very real and concrete harms that come to people. And also it just opens your mind in terms of how to think about things, brainstorming, being around other people, coordinating, organizing. I think these things are all crucial and can only happen when people gather together in the same place.
You've devoted a lot of your writing and research and criticism of the Obama administration for their continuation of the abuses that we saw after 9/11 under George W. Bush. And that includes warrantless surveillance under Obama, indefinite detention, the NDAA that he signed, targeted killings using drones, lots more. But I'm wondering if you would give us sort of your overview of the assault on civil liberties we've seen over the past 4 years of the Obama administration. And what are your fears and maybe hopes for any kind of turnaround in that for Obama in his second term?
I think the essence of it is really twofold. One is that it is grounded in the premise that the United States is a nation at war. And even though there's no clearly defined war and there's no one single country in which the war is being fought in any classical sense, a war mindset has taken hold, both formalistically in terms of what the government sees its powers as being, and culturally in terms of how the population conceives of what the government is doing. And in times of war, it is typically the case that political leaders are less constrained in terms of how they can exercise their power. I think that the way in which this war is defined, that it's a global war, that it's one without any clear end or even clear enemy, means that it's particularly difficult to impose limits. And so essentially the president has taken the position, both the prior one under George Bush and now the Obama administration, has taken the position that the president is essentially unconstrained in what he can do. He can kill whom he wants. He can imprison whom he wants, send the military anywhere with total secrecy, with no due process, no transparency, no oversight. And once you embrace this theory, this theoretical framework, it becomes very difficult to identify any real limits on presidential authority. And I think every example, the ones that you asked me about and the other ones, really stem from this core mindset. And the other aspect of it is that it's directed at a group of people that is perceived as being marginalized and powerless, which are American Muslims. And even though these kind of abuses of power always extend beyond their original application, typically it's the case that if the government can persuade the citizenry that it's only being directed at this group, that the rest of the citizenry can either be indifferent toward it or even supportive of it by being comfortable in the knowledge that it won't actually affect them. This is always a very delusional and false assurance. It's how government leaders convince populations to acquiesce to these things, but that's, I think, at the core of it. And as far as the second term is concerned, one way to look at it is that if you believe that President Obama has been pursuing policies in the first 4 years that he didn't really want to pursue, that he doesn't actually believe in, that he was only pursuing because he had to for political necessity, I suppose he could be optimistic that now that the election is behind him, he'll abandon those policies and do things in a better way. But I don't believe that about him. I don't think that these policies are ones that he is opposed to secretly in his heart. I think he's been very clear and vigorous in his defense of them. There was no political compulsion for him to do these things. He chose to do them on his own. He was elected on a platform of reversing many of these policies. Clearly, he had people behind him who would have supported him if he had. He chose not to. I think that's because he wants to preserve his own power, to expand his own power. And if anything, I believe that the second term means that he no longer needs the core base of his party and can be even more unrestrained in pursuing these policies than he's been in the past. I think the opposite outcome is more likely.
just after the election, there were reports that the Obama administration had tried to codify their kill list for the unmanned aerial drone program. And you've written your concern that this, of course, now institutionalizes this act of the president having the sole power, at least we don't know how the inner workings of the White House, but it seems that he's got personal and complete control over this assassination list, which I think is unprecedented in our history, at least in such an open way, because it's kind of common knowledge that's what's going on. Maybe you could talk about what are any checks and balances on that, you know, incredible grab for power in making these assassination lists that's quite out in the open now.
Well, there are zero checks and balances, and this is the core of the problem, is that there's nobody that can exercise any oversight in terms of who the president decides who should die, the reasons that he decides that, who it is that is putting together the list of potential candidates, and what criteria are used to determine who will be targeted. Not only is there no oversight mechanism or checks and balances of any kind, there's also no due process involved. So the person who is targeted has no opportunity to contest the allegations made against them, to deny the evidence that's being used to suggest that they've done something wrong. And worse still, there's no transparency to it. So we don't even know who the president is targeting for assassination, let alone what his reasons are. So that not only is there no check on or oversight mechanism, which is the crux of the American Republic, that people who can exercise power without checks will inevitably abuse it. That was the whole premise of the founding. But there's not even any transparency for us to know how many people are being targeted, who they are, what the criteria are. It's really the most extreme power a government can exercise, which is the power to have the president execute whomever he wants. And it's done in the most tyrannical way, which is in total secrecy and without due process. And it includes not just foreign nationals, but U.S. citizens as well. And the fact that this power has been so systematically entrenched now means that there really is no conceivable end to it. If Barack Obama has the power and authority to exercise his power, then it means the next president, whether a Republican or a Democrat, will have that authority as well. And that's what makes it so dangerous to acquiesce to it.
In terms of public opposition to this, as you said before, if the majority of the American people think it's just this small marginal group that's being targeted, then you know they have no problem with it, and we've got to protect ourselves. National security over everything else is certainly part of the scene since 9/11. But do you think these imperial presidential powers that Obama has now taken for himself can be challenged in the Supreme Court? And I say that, you know, kind of recognizing there's a very conservative bent to this current Supreme Court, which may reduce the odds of anything happening there. But what are your thoughts on the most effective ways to challenge what Obama is institutionalizing as an imperial presidency?
Well, unfortunately, the Supreme Court, which is really intended to be the ultimate institution to check these abuses, and the reason I say that is because the concern that the founders had most was that these abuses would be directed toward the marginalized groups, the powerless groups, as a way of institutionalizing them. And typically, institutions that are democratically accountable, like the Congress, are afraid to side with marginalized groups by virtue of the fact that they're marginalized. The judiciary was really supposed to be the institution that would have no fear of doing that. That's why they're not elected, they're appointed, and especially why they have life tenure, to immunize them from these politically driven fears of protecting the rights of people who are marginalized. And yet the history of the Supreme Court in the wake of 9/11 is probably the most shameful and disgraceful of any of the institutions that have failed in their duties, because almost invariably the federal judiciary has sided with the U.S. government, especially over the rights of Muslims whenever the word terrorism is invoked. The Constitution has basically been disregarded. We heard at the conference earlier someone from the ACLU who said there's a Muslim exception to the Constitution now. Even establishment sources like Andy Rosenthal, who's the editorial page editor of the New York Times, has written that we've created this separate system of justice for Muslim Americans in the United States in the wake of 9/11. And the federal judiciary really has been completely complicit in that. They've imposed a few very kind of mild restraints on some of presidential power, but by and large, they've acquiesced almost completely to executive power. So the real ultimately, the ultimate check, the last check on abuse of power is supposed to lie with the citizenry. And you did see a lot of pushback in the Bush era when these policies were quite controversial. You had very divisive debates over them. You had all kinds of political movements that were devoted to condemning and denouncing and fighting against assertions of executive transgressions by the Bush administration. You see much, much, much less of that now under the Obama administration, because Democrats were behind most of those protests, and the vast bulk of Democrats are now willing to endorse what they were once just a few years ago condemning, because it's a Democratic president doing it. So ultimately, it's the responsibility of the citizenry to push back against these kind of abuses. The problem has been that partisan allegiance has trumped any sort of commitment to principle and has made these protests really kind of marginalized.
The whole issue of double standards is really stark, I think, as you said, with many of the same people who are just sitting idly by and have no problem with the extension of the Bush abuses of the Constitution were outraged, during the days of George W. Bush. And you talk about the citizenry being sort of the ultimate check on presidential power abuses. As you come to a conference like this, that where the focus is abuse of civil liberties, do you see any hope that there's sort of a kernel of a movement out there that is going to take this on as a major issue and push it to a sort of a national status, so that this can be debated in our society, because it's really not debated at all right now?
Well, I think two things about that. One is, I think the key is to subvert the idea that these abuses are confined to just a small group. And one of the interesting things is, a couple of years ago, there was actually a fairly mainstream backlash against civil liberties abridgments that occurred when the TSA instituted invasive new security procedures at airports, much more modest than the vast bulk of the civil liberties abuses and invasions that have been directed at Muslim Americans over the last decade. But these really resonated, because as the controversy went, it was being targeted even at people's grandmothers at airports. And so you see, though, the principle there, that when people feel personally implicated by civil liberties abridgments, even relatively minor ones, they do get engaged by them. And so being able to find ways to communicate to people that things like the sprawling surveillance state, the ability to indefinitely detain people, the ability to target people for death without due process is directly threatening to them and their interest, is the prerequisite for galvanizing public response. But I think once that way is found, that absolutely can happen. The other thing I think is critically important is to break the partisan prism in which these issues exist. So what you find for now is that when there's a Democratic president, Republicans get very vigorous about defending the Constitution and restraining federal power. And then when there's a Republican president in office, they no longer care about those things at all, because they are now the ones with their hands on the levers of power. The same is true for Democrats. I think making this a transpartisan, trans-ideological issue is really the key, and it relates to what I just talked about in terms of engaging people in the first point. And I think you are starting to see some of that. Now there are actually Tea Party factions in the Congress who are far more concerned about privacy issues and civil liberties issues than, say, mainstream Democrats. You have people on the left and the right being able to work together. If you look at the genesis of the Tea Party movement in the United States and the Occupy movement in the United States, they had a lot more in common than is generally perceived, not just opposition to things like bailouts, but even extreme government power. And that's because civil liberties abuses are devoted to persecuting people who are kind of on the margins. And people who are on the margins, meaning have minority views, minority religions, on the left or right, really do have a common interest in defending these principles. And I think the more merger there is of that, the more kind of transpartisan alliance and coalition there is, the better and more effective it'll be.
I wanted to ask you about the media and the media's coverage of civil liberties issues. I know you've been quite critical of the mainstream corporate media, but you've also been critical of the so-called left, the progressive media, as they kind of gingerly danced around these civil liberties issues. Again, do you see any signs that things might be changing, or is this kind of just ingrained here that the media is very servile towards power generally, and with the demise of newspapers and money for investigative reporting generally, you have a less effective check on power, in terms of journalism and media?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to distinguish between the establishment media and then progressive media. So I think establishment media, their allegiance very much is to just power in general. They were incredibly servile to the Bush administration, as even George Bush's press secretary, Scott McClellan, mocked them for being in his book once he left. And they are equally servile to power now that the Obama administration is in office. Their servility to power transcends any partisan allegiance. It exists permanently. It's really their ideology. They revere the media, the CIA, the intelligence and military agencies. They're afraid to challenge them. They're really there to amplify and bolster their primacy. So I don't think you can look to corporate-owned establishment media, with some rare exceptions, to pose any meaningful challenge to people in power. As far as progressive media is concerned, I think their overarching devotion is simply to the Democratic Party and any Democratic politicians. And the idea that they're going to provide any meaningful check on a Democratic president, I think, is equally fanciful. That said, I do think that the internet has enabled the emergence of a whole variety of more independent and more diverse voices that can reach large audiences, mobilize people, do real journalism of the kind that both establishment and partisan media either fail or refuse to do. And I think that's a cause for optimism.
Just have a last question here on another topic, and that is the current negotiations over the so-called fiscal cliff and the sense that many people have looking back to last summer, 2011, when Barack Obama was in negotiations with John Boehner and was ready to give away a lot on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, embracing things back then like increasing the eligibility age for Medicare. In the current negotiations, there's a lot of unions and other progressive groups who've drawn a line in the sand, so to speak, and said that they will not tolerate those kind of betrayals, as many of them talk about it, if the negotiations take a turn like they did last year. What's your sense of what's going to happen in this fiscal cliff negotiation in terms of preserving and protecting those three major social safety net programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security?
Well, first of all, the last thing that I would ever take seriously are claims from progressive groups about what they will and will not tolerate. If you look at how the healthcare debate progressed, not just progressive groups, but also the Progressive Caucus and the House of Representatives decreed as definitively and unconditionally as you can decree that under no circumstances would they ever, ever support any health care bill that did not have a public option in it, because all it would do is bolster the private health care industry. And yet when the bill came to be voted on and did not have a public option, and they were told that their duty as good Democrats compelled a vote in favor of it, progressive pundits who made this pledge decided to advocate for it. Members of Congress in the Progressive Caucus who swore they would never vote for it ended up voting for it anyway. And so what they've done is essentially announce that our commitments and promises and pledges should never be taken seriously, because our duty as good partisans will always trump any commitment that we make to our principle. And so I don't think you can take seriously the idea that there will be a strong progressive wing that will remain opposed to any deal that Obama wants to do. They've proven in the past that they won't. We know that Obama wants to cut Social Security and Medicare because, as you suggested, he's already tried to get Republicans to agree to that in the past. The only reason it didn't happen is because of Republican recalcitrance. There are reports already that things like increasing the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 67 is something that the Democrats absolutely believe will be in the final deal. Whether they will cut Social Security benefits as part of this deal or just create an independent commission to do that is up in the air, so I don't know how that will play out. But in terms of the politics of it, I think that whatever deal the president decides he wants to do, and he's very much interested in cementing his legacy as this kind of transpartisan compromiser. That's really what he has always wanted to be perceived as, this sort of figure who rises above partisan disputes and brings the two sides together. I think that, you know, there may be some complaining, some very kind of mild objections, but by and large, the faction that supports the Democratic Party and the progressive wing of that party will be behind it and will find reasons, if not to glorify it, at least to justify and excuse it. And so I think the last thing he's worried about as he tries to do this deal is what the reaction will be of Democratic partisans.
Again, the only check and balance on that kind of negotiation and what I would, and maybe our listeners would consider a betrayal, is people getting out in the street and making a lot of noise. But we'll see if that happens.
Yeah, it's. I mean, people sometimes look at protesting Obama's policies or the Democratic Party as some kind of harm to the republic. The real harm to the republic is from marching lockstep behind a politician and abdicating your duty as a citizen not to demand that your political values be adhered to. That's what the democracy is all about. And, you know, ultimately you strengthen a political leader and you strengthen your political party when you demand that it does the things that you think are right.
Glenn Greenwald, thanks so much for making time for our discussion, and we'll look forward to your writings in The Guardian and your forthcoming books. Any projects you want to mention that you got going on?
No, I'm actually working on a book, but it's not going to be out for a while, so I'm still figuring out what it is. But I appreciate your taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.